The Top 100 Project is sponsored by anyone? Anyone? By Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug uses only anyone? Anyone? Only premium Arabica beans, directly sourced and fairly traded. Sparkplug offers blends and roasts to suit anyone's taste, including anyone? Decaf and anyone? Half calf for people who don't have any trouble staying awake during an economics lecture. Does anyone know what makes Sparkplug coffee special? Anyone? Sparkplug is special because the coffee is delivered within a week of being custom roasted, so that it's delivered at its peak flavor. Is freshly roasted coffee hard to come by? Class? Anyone? It is. Coffee sold at the grocery store or in shops could have been roasted at any time, sometimes months before it got to the shelves. But it's a widely accepted fact that freshly roasted coffee has a superior flavor to stale coffee. Can anyone tell me how to get Sparkplug coffee? Anyone done this before? Anyone gone to sparkplugcoffee.com? Anyone? At sparkplugcoffee.com, you can order Sparkplug coffee directly to your home or office. So, if you want your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen, you go to anyone? Somethingcoffee.com? Class? Anyone? You go to sparkplugcoffee.com.
That's certainly better than the Holly Smoot lecture he gives in the movie.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, movie lovers, and Donka Shane. Oh, darling, Donka Shane. For checking out the next 100 project. Spoiler alert, we're going to spoil a bunch of movies today. I'm Ryan Ellis, and here she is, my lovely co-host and wife, Beverly.
That's me.
Okay, lots of Ferris Bueller-related themes already today. So, the coming attractions trivia for Ferris Bueller's Day Off. John Hughes directed only 8 movies, none of them sequels. He wrote a lot of movies for other directors. How many of those were sequels?
I was surprised just how vast his writing credits were. Mm-hmm. He wrote a lot of movies, including the first 3 Vacation movies, which is 2 sequels right there.
European Vacation and then Christmas Vacation, the beloved favorite for so many people at Christmas time.
He also wrote all 3 Home Alones.
Well, we're talking about sequels, though, so we're talking about now.
Okay.
2 and 2. Home Alone 2, Home Alone 3, and of course
2 sequels for Home Alone, 2 sequels for Vacation, and 4 sequels for Beethoven.
Incorrect.
What? Oh, wait, I'm forgetting something. No, I'm not. What am I forgetting?
He didn't write those, and they weren't theatrical movies anyway. He's only given character credit on those ones.
Damn it! So it was 4. Actually his screenplays. The correct answer is 4. Mm-hmm.
But you caught onto the theme that this man writes a lot of screenplays for other people and also produces a lot of movies for other people. Or he did. I mean, he's been dead for many years now. So the next 100 Project's 20th movie, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. And of course, it didn't make it. Paramount released the flick on June 11th, 1986, 30 years ago, later this week, in fact. I think people know this movie, Bev, but for those who aren't familiar with it, explain it to them with the skinny.
Matthew Broderick is, of course, popular Chicago-area high schooler Ferris Bueller, who skips school on a beautiful day in June. His mission, to rescue his best friend Cameron, played by Alan Ruck, from deep depression by showing him a great day in Chi-Town. Jeffrey Jones is Dean of Students Ed Rooney, who's determined to find Ferris and punish him.
Or, in a nutshell, educator is fanatically determined to expose truant smartass. People often overlook that fact that Ferris Bueller is just this close to being a smug dick.
He is right on that tightrope. And for some people, I think he is crossing that line.
But even for people who might be... Well, we're not in the demographic for this movie anymore, I suppose, are we? I'm in my 40s. But anyway, if you were 20 or if you're in your teens and saw this movie, even some of them might have thought, he's a rich kid. He's not mega rich, though. And that's one of the things about this movie that was a little different. He's not a jock, and he's not incredibly rich, as he even says, doesn't have a car. But he's still so popular with everybody, mm-hmm. which is a little unrealistic.
And he's that bulletproof charm and confidence. Mm-hmm. I've known people before who just hate him as a character and hated this movie and just could not get over the fact that he is such an overdog that he just wins.
An overdog. Wins. Oh, I like that. Well, I don't like it, but I get what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Term. Okay, so a few numbers first. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 80% of them are fans, 49 fresh, 12 rotten, 92% of audiences. So a nice little swing of 12% there. And Richard Roper, who did Ebert Roper for many years, is one of the biggest fans of this film in the critical community. He called it effortless escapism. And he also has a theory that we'll get to later in this podcast about what the story is really about. The movie was 10th at the 1986 U.S. box office and made 10 times its budget. Top Gun was number one in 86, and Platoon, an AFI film we covered many months ago, was number three.
It's funny you mention Roper, that he's a champion for this film, because one of the, more than you would think, rotten reviews on Rotten Tomatoes came from Gene Siskel.
Oh, the guy he replaced, yeah, who didn't like it. Ebert was in the middle of the two of them. I think he liked the movie, didn't love it. Roper, of course, does, and Siskel, as you say, did not. And this is a travelogue of Chicago. The movie is hitting on those points. He was criticized, Hughes was, for that. But then his response was, Woody Allen does that in New York all the time. Why can't I do that for Chicago? So you see the art museum, you see the stock exchange, the tallest building in Chicago. They go on a fancy lunch and, of course, the parade at the end. That's part of the fun of it. It is effortless escapism. So there's no reason why you can't just show all the highlights of Chicago. And they also go to, of course, a baseball game. I forgot about that. They go to Wrigley Field. The movie takes place on June 5th, 1985. We're going to release this podcast on June the 6th, 2016. So we're almost exactly right when it's set. We're 31 years after that, I guess. But of course, it was released in 86. But we've gone way into the podcast and haven't even asked what we each thought of it. So what are your initial thoughts? Well, not really initial anymore, but your like or not like thoughts of Ferris Bueller.
Well, I grew up watching Ferris. It caught me right at the perfect time. When I was the perfect age to enjoy it, when it was on TV a lot. It used to be on TV, and I was like 10, 11, 14, whatever, watching it all the time. So I am far from impartial. I just love it. But I really think that it holds up well. Like, it's just so damn charming. I can't believe there are people who weren't won over by it.
Well, knowing the reasons, and we've already discussed what those reasons are for those people, you can't see their point of view on that, because I'm even saying it as a fan of the film. That he does toe that line so precipitously.
I think there are differing opinions on this, but I would say that Ferris isn't necessarily a good person, that his motives are not as altruistic as some people would like to believe that they are in order to rationalize liking it. But to me, it overcomes that. It probably really does come down to Matthew Broderick's performance. He just has this perfect boyish charm. It's just really hard not to love him. When I was a girl, I should have had a crush on him, but really, watching that film, I just wanted to be him so badly.
You wanted to be the most popular boy in school.
I wanted to be,
girl in school, I guess.
But I wanted to be funny. I wanted to be irreverent the way he was, and live in the moment the way he did, and not care about consequences, and be spontaneous the way he was.
Did you also want to be a great actor? Because this guy, the character now, not Broderick, must be an incredible actor. 9 sick days. And of course he fixes that on the computer to only be 2 sick days, but he does have 9 officially. How gullible are his parents? But then they are absentee parents.
Okay, but you say that, but his mother is shocked to learn that he's had 9 sick days, so I think it's probably more likely that he gets Sloane or some other girlfriend of his to call up the school and pretend to be his mother. His parents are not aware of how many times he's been playing hooky.
Yeah, maybe he's actually just cutting class in a different kind of way than what he shows in the film. I suppose it's possible, but John Hughes had pretty big issues with bad or neglectful folks because Breakfast Club has that theme. The Home Alone movies certainly have that theme. Yeah. And not even necessarily that they're terrible parents in the Home Alone movies or this one, but they're just not quite aware of what's really going on with their kids. And in Breakfast Club, there's that line that Ally Sheedy has, when you grow up, your heart dies. And that's one of the more profound and maybe not quite accurate
melodramatic lines that he ever wrote.
Yeah, and of course, we're the age of the people that we're talking about, maybe even older than the parents would have been. For the characters in Breakfast Club. I don't think my heart's died, but then I also don't have any kids to deal with.
I'm not as passionate about certain things as I was when I was a teenager, but I still have passion. I just direct it in other ways, I suppose. I think you definitely become more rational, and you become less irrational is probably a more accurate way to put it. But something that John Hughes does amazing and what he gets an enormous amount of credit for is the way that he treats the emotions, even exaggerated and you could say incorrect emotions, melodramatic emotions of teenagers with seriousness and respect. And his actors frequently said that was something that made him special. He treated them like real, fluid, and complete human beings, not like these caricatures like a lot of teen movies did.
He almost always worked with kids in his 8 movies, except for, I suppose, Uncle Buck. Well, no, there's kids in there too.
Yeah.
But the main character in that one is an adult, John Candy. But most of his films, so then again, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Couple of kids, but small roles.
She's having a baby. I don't think there's any teenagers or children in that movie.
Yeah.
So she has the
baby. But his Red Letter Movies, and this may be his Red Letterist of Red Letter Movies, along with Breakfast Club.
Breakfast Club, yeah.
And those are about some adults. Of course, Paul Gleason in Breakfast Club as the principal, the asshole that he is in
He's
that
the
film.
Foil, so I don't know if that counts.
Just like Rooney is in this film. But he does seem to be very able to relate to high school teenagers in Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Weird Science,
and then
16 Candles, and some of the characters like the younger kids in Uncle Buck, Macaulay Culkin. And then he
The teenager in Uncle Buck, a teen angsty girl.
Right, and as we said, he wrote Home Alone, so he had to know how to write for was he 9 years old, I guess?
Roughly.
Macaulay Culkin. And then Curly Sue, his last directorial effort with a very young girl. I don't remember that movie at all. I know I saw it, but... But contrasting all of that, the characters in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, or at least Cameron and Sloane, we didn't say her name yet, Mia Sara, whose first two movies were legend with Ridley Scott and Tom Cruise, for that matter, as the actor, and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Great start for her. Hughes cast her for her elegance. And I remember that Roger Ebert said she's the impossibly beautiful Mia Sara.
Yeah, she's a great composer.
But here's my point, though. So Sloane and Cameron have that conversation right before the big moment on the float. When Ferris sings Donkey Shane and, of course, Twist and Shout. And they're talking about, what do you want to do when you grow up? What are you interested in? Nothing. And then I think it's she that says that and he agrees, or maybe it's the reverse of that. They don't know. And, of course, how are they supposed to know? They're, what are they, 16 or 18 years old? So there he's got his finger on the pulse of the kids again, but they're also the contradictory thing where Ferris has all the answers, but these other two don't have any answers.
But then follows one of my favorite lines of the film, and I think one of the most telling lines in the film. Someone asks, what do you think Ferris is going to end up doing? And the other one says, he's going to be a fry cook at Venus. They seem to agree on that. As charming as Ferris is now, as charmed as his life is now, this is temporary. And that's a big theme of the film, to seize the day, because they are probably living the happiest time in their life. Ferris directly addresses this in his Breaking the Fourth Wall talking to camera, and he says, what's the famous line? Sometimes you gotta...
Well, it was nominated for the AFI's Top 100 Quotes list, so it's, life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Right, and he has another moment where he pauses and talks to camera about how they're going to go to college next year, and him and Cameron will go to different colleges, and Sloane will be stuck doing another year of high school, and he knows they're going to grow apart. He knows that this time is temporary, and he's determined to enjoy it now and squeeze every moment of living out of it. I think it's pretty clear by the scenes when they cut back to, the hilarious scenes where he cut back to high school to the economics lecture that I lampooned in my Sparkplug copy. They're not missing anything in high school. It's not like they would have learned much more in high school than they learned on their adventures. They actually have a pretty industrious and educational adventure.
Yeah, most times kids cut class. It's not to do anything nearly as interesting or as cool as this.
Not when I cut class, at least.
But you're right. In this case, it was productive. That's true. I'm thinking now of a TV series that was very popular on Fox in the late 80s into the 90s. Not The Simpsons, the other one. Married with Children, where Al Bundy was living in his high school past. Mm. All he ever had after he became a shoe salesman was memories of being a football star.
Popular.
Yes, and Ferris might be going down that same road, although he seems like he's smart enough. He seems to be a computer genius, much like the character he played in War Games a couple years before. He's able to hack into things he shouldn't be able to hack into, changing the absentees he's had in the year. That shows a lot of potential for a young possible computer nerd. And we know where those guys, Jobs and Gates, ended up.
Maybe Cameron and Sloane are underestimating just how many doors open for somebody who has that kind of charisma that Ferris has. I will once again quote 30 Rock when I say, you're a tall white man with all your hair. The sky's the limit. It doesn't matter if he's responsible or if he gets his act together. He'll always have doors open for him.
The hair and tall thing includes Cameron. He's taller than Ferris is. Is Ferris just a figment of Cameron's imagination?
Okay. I see how this is a theory that is fun to talk about and think about, but I just don't see it when I watch the movie.
I don't really see it either. I've heard that before, and of course it's been analyzed by people who've done a pretty good job of it. But there are other theories about movies. How one of the fun things we've done in our podcast is to explore that kind of stuff, the reasonably good questions thing, which is all about how you got to pick apart plot. And so many great websites and podcasts do that probably way better than we ever could. They also have a paid staff to do that stuff. I don't think the theory that Ferris is not real holds up, but I do like the theory that it's a suicide prevention. Cameron is so down, and it's also the irony that Ferris calls in sick and isn't sick at all. Cameron must have called in sick, but he actually is sick in bed, but is it all just in his head? So the theory that Roper and other people have thrown out there is that Ferris is taking Cameron out for this great day because he's trying to keep him from saying, fuck it, I'm going to kill myself.
So I had this conversation with a friend of mine who says that Ferris Bueller is his all-time favorite movie. And we were discussing whether or not Ferris's motives are altruistic. He, having seen the film a zillion times, says, absolutely not. Ferris is a selfish jerk. He likes Cameron. Cameron is his friend. He cares about Cameron. But not enough to stop himself from taking Cameron's dad's car and making him a nervous wreck about it all day. Or even after he takes his car, letting Cameron, I don't know, drive it. Or sit anywhere except squeeze into the back seat the way that he is. He never listens to Cameron. He just does what he wants because he wants to do it. And he looks directly in the camera and he admits that it's just because he wants to drive that car. He never says to the camera and all the things he says, oh, I just did this to get Cameron out of the blues. No, he did it because he wants to, because it's fun. And he brings Cameron around just because he likes him. When Cameron starts to get really down and he tries to sort of drown himself in the pool, he goes in and tries to save him and gives him like a little pep talk. But really, it's all about Ferris.
Well, in that scene in the hot tub at the end and Cameron falls face first into the pool, there's a couple of key moments in that. About 20 years before, The Graduate came out, and you've got a bit of an homage here with the character underwater. Mm-hmm. Rushmore did that too about 10 years after this film. And it seems like he wants to stay underwater. But then he looks up because Cameron knows Ferris is going to come in to save him. And then when Ferris does jump in to save him, Cameron's playing like he's drowning. But if you look, he's kicking along with him. People have pointed out in the IMDb goof section a long time ago about how that is a mistake. But no, because the idea is that Cameron doesn't actually want to drown. Of course he's going to kick with him because he's actually getting low on air and he wants to get back to the surface. So suicide prevention, I'm not really sure specifically at the moment what those guys, Roper and other people, have said about how that plays into this and how specific it gets. But I think I'm with you on that Ferris is a friend to this guy and does want to help him, but he's also doing some shitty things along the way. He is, as I said earlier, a bit of a smug dick. When they park the car, he says to Richard Edson, who was in Platoon and Do the Right Thing for us on the Top Niner project, do you speak English? And of course the guy speaks fluent English. And then later on, Ferris pretends to be Abe Froman. The way he handles that snooty waiter is dickish on Ferris's part, too. They're both being assholes, actually, and he's also being a lying fraud. Ferris is.
I know there's a deleted scene where poor Abe Froman and his party of three are denied a table.
And back to those garage attendants, it does seem a little unusual that they're not surly cross-puzzle enthusiasts. They're actually joyriding thieves. But I guess that's what happens when you condescend to somebody and say, do you speak English?
Yeah, and maybe they're just Ferris Bueller in 10, 15 years. He sees the day.
Take advantage of a great opportunity to drive an awesome car. But let's get back to the whole dickish thing with Ferris. Did you notice in the opening of the movie when he's doing his whole fake sick thing, Jeannie's in the room too, right away doesn't believe it. Okay, here, Jennifer Grey, we haven't mentioned her yet, plays his sister. He looks over at her and winks. So right away he's giving away the game if the parents had been paying attention at all. They might as well be Peanuts characters going, wah, 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 wah. As is true about the Breakfast Club parents, too, I would say. But he owns up to that right off the bat that he's not legit sick. Jeannie and Ed Rooney are mostly right.
Yeah.
Jeannie trying to expose him and Ed Rooney trying to expose him, although those two end up being adversaries because he is breaking into their house, and then, of course, he's going to side with her brother. That reminds me of some of my cousins who fought all the time. But if anybody ever fucked with them outside the family, then they had their back, and there was no doubt about that.
Rooney also crosses the line by breaking into their house. Mm-hmm. He's a somewhat cartoonish villain. He's so determined to get Ferris that he commits break and enter and terrifies Jeannie. Part of it is that she hates him for doing that, for terrifying her. And part of it, is probably just that she's always going to stick with her brother. As much as she hates Ferris, she does kind of love Ferris. He is her brother. Her and Rooney, all they would have had to do was combine forces. And very quickly, they could have overcome Ferris.
With our combined strength, we can end this destructive conflict and bring order to the galaxy.
But she's a fun character. She has a fun arc. Her arc is mostly just getting over her jealousy of Ferris. And she gets over it by...
Talking to Charlie Sheen,
of all people. Charlie Sheen, I know.
The voice of reason.
Who apparently stayed up 2 days straight so that he could appear strung out as he was in that scene, and he does appear strung out.
I think we got a bit of a Dustin Hoffman and Marathon Man thing all over again, that famous story when Hoffman stayed up all night to look like he'd been up for days on end, and Laurence Olivier apparently said to him, why don't you just try acting? And Hoffman's explanation about that was, okay, well, that story is a little apocryphal because A, Olivier said, I've done all kinds of crazy things too, but also Hoffman said, well, that was the days of Club 54, so you're up all night because you want to party and fuck. And I'm sure Charlie Sheen, certainly knowing what we know about him now, was doing that more than being a method actor.
That scene is so funny, though. And I mean, it stands out in a movie that we haven't really mentioned it yet. It's a fucking hilarious movie. And the scene between Jeannie or Shauna and Charlie Sheen stands out as being really hilarious. And I think it's kind of a refreshing scene because you see Jeannie finally lighten up.
And be giddy and a little goofy. Sheen was in Platoon and Lucas this same year as this film, so what a great threesome in one year. He's in a Best Picture winner and one of his most notable movies. And then Lucas is an underrated film. We've mentioned Roger Ebert a lot in this podcast. He loves that movie, as do I.
Yeah, I loved it too.
And Sheen is a pretty good guy in that film too. He can be a good actor. He certainly was in this time frame, and he is pretty cool. But does he actually give Jeannie good advice? Don't worry about your brother so much. Yeah, let him do his own thing. You should talk to this guy, Ferris Bueller. He'll set you straight. Is it good advice? I suppose it probably
is. It's great advice.
So the other conflict, and the main conflict, I suppose, in the whole film, because Jeannie certainly is a conflict for Ferris, but Rooney, he and Ferris never speak in any scene where they share screen time. They're not very often in person. It's almost always on phones or through the intercom system. Well, I guess Ferris isn't actually there for that either. He's on a recording. But it's a nice touch. One is always silent in every conversation. Thank you to the IMDb for that one. I never really noticed that until I read that. But they are correct.
Until the very end, it's as though Ferris isn't even aware that Rooney is so doggedly pursuing him.
Of course he's not. Why would he be?
He's oblivious.
We talked about this on Thelma and Louise, that they shouldn't have any reason to think that they're being hunted by the cops. Mm-hmm. Well, it's same with Ferris. Why does he think that Rooney is so determined this one time? I'm going to get him now in June. He fucked me over in November and in January and in April. But now June, I'm going to get him. And of course, he's not fucking over him at all. Rooney cares too much. My nutshell was siding with him. He's trying to be a good dean, but he's also caring way too much about one kid, and he's left his school for hours at a time, most of the day, to try to track down Ferris to prove what exactly.
What does he say? Gives good kids bad ideas.
I guess he would just give him detention for the rest of the year, a la Bart Simpson or something, but...
He threatens to make him repeat the year of high school, which is a significant threat, but is it a significant threat to Ferris,
who is already admitted? Anyway.
Yeah, he's upset about finishing high school. He doesn't want to leave Sloane. He doesn't want to be separated from his best friend. And he knows these are his golden years, and it's not likely to get better than this.
And everybody loves him, so why not stay in high school? What did you think of Geoffrey Jones' performance? Coming off of Amadeus, where he plays the Emperor, and that was the Best Picture winner. Pretty good success a couple years before this film. And he's also fun in Ed Wood and other Tim Burton movies, for that matter. I guess he's also known for his pederasty thing now.
Yeah, Geoffrey Jones apparently said in interviews, John Hughes had told him this performance was going to be the performance that everyone knew him for the rest of his life. And it was until he got busted for having child porn.
Well, it's not performing, so the performance thing
stands okay, up. Yes. This is definitely his signature performance. He was cast by Hughes because of his performance in Amadeus. He wanted Rooney to be like this petulant little emperor, and he was. And he also has those great facial features. You know, he has those bug eyes and that beaky nose, and there's something that's already a caricature about him. A lot of things come together to make this film the lightning in a bottle that it is, and his performance as the foil, who is more of a foil to himself than he is to Ferris, is part of what makes it great. He's really, really funny.
And it could have been Paul Gleason, who is the bad guy, or at least the foil, in The Breakfast Club, the one who's got them all doing detention, who also is obviously jealous of some of the things that those guys have going for them, because they could go off and do great things, especially Molly Ringwald's character and Emilio Estevez's characters. And for that matter, I suppose Anthony Michael Hall, not so much Bender.
But he's not funny in The Breakfast Club. I mean, no, he has funny moments, but Geoffrey Jones is hilarious. So much so that he's like the big final laugh in the credits when he has to board the bus. And the gummy bears. He's not the very last scene. The very last scene is Ferris telling everybody to go home, which is hilarious as well.
I read somewhere that that's one of the rare times ever in movies where an actor or an actress was billed in the film before they actually had appeared. I think it's Girl on the Bus. Her credit appears before he actually sits down beside her.
Oh, really?
And Alanis Morissette, I think, would be in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, because she played God in Dogma, so she's the god of the Viewers universe, is the very last thing in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, as I recall. I think I've got that right. But she's billed before she appears, because she's the very last thing. So two examples. And hey, Shermer, where this is set, Shermer High School, Jay and Silent Bob in Dogma are coming back from going to Shermer.
Yes!
This fictional town that Hughes invented.
Yeah, there's a whole hilarious scene in Dogma where Jay and Silent Bob are explaining that the reason they're in Illinois is because they're looking for this fictional town. They didn't realize it was fictional because Silent Bob has this whole theory that there's this town where all the honeys are fly and all the guys are dweebs. So they figured they would just go to this town and totally clean up.
Because they're cool enough that they would score.
Well, the dweebs get the girls, then obviously they would get hot chicks. So funny.
Kevin Smith is a big fan of the Hughes-averse. All right, well then, the big centerpiece scene of the whole film would have to be on the parade float, where it's Don Shane and Twist and Shout, which is the ultimate fantasy fulfillment of coolness.
Mm-hmm.
He's got dozens, hundreds, maybe even 1,000 people in the palm of his hand. And Matthew Broderick actually had that too, because yes, he was lip-syncing the whole thing, but he was on this float in an actual parade in Chicago that's actually held in September, but supposed to be June. Coolness personified.
In a parade that's taking place on a weekday. For some reason. If I can throw in a reasonable question.
Reasonably good question.
Yeah. If I can throw
trademark. You can't have it. But anyway, go ahead. It's my thing, but go ahead.
I don't know if I saw this movie as an adult, if I would have bought that scene the way I fully bought it when I saw this movie as a kid. Mm-hmm. I just think it's hilarious. His performance is so filled with charm. He's such like a natural star. And Matthew Broderick got a start on Broadway, so it is perfectly likely that's why he has this incredible stage persona. They did have all this choreography that was choreographed by Kenny Ortega, the choreographer for Dirty Dancing, the other Jennifer Grey movie mm-hmm. that people know. But they couldn't really do the choreography because he had hurt his knee during the scene where he's running through all the backyards, mm-hmm. which I guess they shot beforehand. So he just kind of had to wing it. He still has this incredible stage persona.
I also heard that Paul McCartney doesn't like they had the brass band pipe up, but they were there for the parade. So Hughes said, well, we had to incorporate them. They were actually there. It's not actually a twist and show, Paul. But anyway, it's not a big thing.
Yeah, whatever.
And Hughes apparently is a huge Beatles fan anyway, so it's still an homage. And the movie briefly becomes a musical, which also Kevin Smith has done before, including in Clerks 2 when they play ABC 123. Is that what that song's called? Well, anyway, you know, ABC. So other nice touches in the film, the hockey jersey the camera wears through the entire thing, and of course these characters wear the same clothes the whole film, except then again, Ferris does wear different clothes when Cameron is playing Mr. Peterson on the phone, and every time they cut back to him faking out Rooney, Ferris has different clothes on, including the whole James Bond parody, Bueller, Ferris Bueller. But then after that, they all wear the same clothes the rest of the day, because it is set over the course of a few hours. But Cameron's hockey jersey is Gordie Howe, the Red Wings, who actually were shitty in the mid-80s. As great as they've been through most of my adulthood, I became a Red Wings fan in the late 80s. But also you've got a big Chicago rival. Well, maybe not then because they were terrible, but Detroit and Chicago hockey rivals for decades. And I guess Gordie Howe, the actual guy, was pretty happy to see his jersey on screen for so much of a popular film. Mm-hmm. The young kids were seeing too, because of course I think he was retired by the mid-80s. He must have been. He played forever. And then the car, the Ferrari. There's a lot of information online about this. I don't want to get into this because I don't really give a fuck about a car. It's not that impressive. It's not that cool. It's a cool car, granted, but so what? But then last week we had the cool T-Bird and Thelma Louise, and now we've got the Ferrari and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. But here's an example of how Ferris doesn't have all the answers. The whole thing about taking the miles off the odometer by putting it in reverse. I didn't know that wasn't legit when I saw the movie when I was teens, I guess I probably saw this, maybe the late 80s on videotape. But I think anybody with any common sense probably has to think, that's not going to work, man.
Yeah.
And as for the last scene where Cameron destroys the car by kicking at it and then it flies out of the garage, Mr. Fry is going to just beat the piss out of Cameron. Do you not agree?
Yeah, but his father, from what it sounds like, doesn't really love him anyway, mm-hmm. so he could physically hurt him, but could he actually hurt Cameron? And what really takes place there is Cameron saying, fuck it, I don't care if my dad loves me. I hope he hates me. Yeah, he'll have to deal with me. At least this will get his attention, and then I can just walk away from him. Maybe he'll do that thing that's bad enough that I will no longer feel like I owe this man anything because he hasn't been a good dad.
Bad dads is a big theme for John Hughes. You implied a few minutes ago the actors are typecast in this film, and I'm going to say it now. Were all these actors typecast after they appeared in this film? The major cast, not Charlie Sheen, obviously. Edie McClurg, who has the fun role as a secretary. Also in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles yes. for Hughes the next year. But of the main actors, Broderick, certainly Ruck, Sarah, who didn't really do anything else of note after that. Jennifer Grey, who just did Dirty Dancing of note and really nothing else after that. And then Jeffrey Jones.
I don't think of Matthew Broderick's current career, like in the last decade or two, as really being anything like Ferris Bueller. As a matter of fact, considering the amount of charm and charisma that he shows in this film, the screen presence that he shows, I don't think he ever repeats that performance in anything he does again.
That's a good point. I say typecast, and maybe that's not the right word for him, just that he never possibly got to this level again and was as popular as this again. But he does do two movies in 1999 and 2000 where he's the opposite. He's more like Rooney.
Yes.
In Election,
yeah.
And You Can Count on Me. He's a sniveling coward in both of those
films. You Can Count on Me, he's a straight-up creep. Election, he's like a borderline creeper. He's a guy who you can relate to, who makes bad decisions that you can kind of understand. Another great movie that we should cover sometime because it is absolutely hilarious. But perhaps his charisma comes through in his Broadway shows. I saw him on Broadway 2 decades ago in How to Succeed in Business, and he was incredible and brought that charisma to stage. And then, of course, he had the Hamilton of the 90s, which was The Producers. Mm-hmm.
Which was not a good movie, though, ironically, because I heard it's essentially the same thing as what they did on Broadway, including the director was the same person.
Hmm.
And Mel Brooks, it's his whole thing. He still was involved as a producer and wrote the book, as they say, on Broadway. I don't know why it didn't work. The original is way better, at least as a comedy and really as a movie itself, with Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder. I like Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane, who are both in The Lion King as voice actors many years before. But I don't think either one of them is nearly as good as Mostel and Wilder were in the original Producers.
That's a shame. Some things just don't translate to film. Or perhaps somebody who's a good stage director isn't necessarily a good film director.
So maybe I'm wrong to imply he was typecast because he does have all these other great performances. But this is still, I think, his most famous one. Although, curiously, he does not have an arc in this picture, much like Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man and many other great performances. In this one, it's obviously Cameron who has the arc.
Yeah.
And he is a bit of a device. Is even real. But we didn't really get that far into that because we don't really think that's legit. It doesn't really hold up. I don't think John Hughes intended that. You can say that about a lot of filmmakers, what they really intended, or if they would maybe never answer what you think about this theory or that theory about so many popular films. But I don't think John Hughes intended that at all. If you want to read into that, that Ferris is a figment of Cameron's imagination, or even if he's just enhanced from what he really is. But anyway,
it's a fun, yeah, it's a fun theory to entertain, but I don't really buy it.
And you can name a young actor in the 80s, and that young actor was considered for Ferris. There's probably even a longer list of people who were considered for Jeannie. What about Jennifer Grey? Does Dirty Dancing the next year. Not much else after that. What do you think of her as Jeannie?
I love her in Dirty Dancing, and I love her in this. She's so committed. She's like such great bitch face, right? But then when she's scared and she's kicking Rooney in the face, she's a good actress. She's a great comic actress.
And I don't know if I fully believe she would go over to Ferris's side right away when she hears Rooney finally gets him outside their back door. But then again, we go back to what I said a few minutes ago about how I don't like you, Rooney, and Ferris is a dick for getting away with this stuff all the time, but you don't fuck with my brother.
She has nothing at stake. Whether Ferris gets away with it or not, her life doesn't necessarily change. She just kind of has this personal vendetta because she considers it unjust that he gets away with everything he gets away with. And actually, that's true for Rooney, too. Whether Ferris gets away with it or not, his life doesn't necessarily need to change. They both just have these almost irrational vendettas against him.
As did Paul Gleason's character in Breakfast Club. He seems to be too pissed off with these kids, especially Bender. I mean, his whole thing with Bender in that film is, I'm not going to let you fuck up these other kids. But he threatens to punch him in the face. Take your shot. Take your first. Come on, I'm daring you. You're a grown man, and as bad as Bender is as a kid, and as bad as a student as he obviously is, although we see what he's really like in the end, you're threatening to hit him, or at least have him hit you first?
Yeah, and if you're an educator with any experience whatsoever, then you have to know intimately that someone like Bender is just not going to have that much influence over his peers, especially peers that are that far out of his social strata as the other kids are.
Until they're forced to sit with him in detention for an entire day.
Yeah, forced by him.
Alan Ruck, of course, he was typecast because he had that small role in Speed, and he was in Spin City, the TV show that Michael J. Fox did. But nothing else, anything close to this. He was nearly 30 during filming.
Yeah.
So talk about being way too old for the role. But then he doesn't look 30, I wouldn't say. He looks like he could pass for maybe 20-ish. But I've never really dwelled on that too much anyway. The 90210 thing. I mean, look how old. What's his name? The guy who plays Dylan? Is that his name?
Luke Perry.
Luke Perry. Look how old he looks through the whole thing. But he gives a shit. If he's a good actor, you buy it. It's not really that important. Anthony Michael Hall could have been Cameron. And then John Candy auditioned. I could see Hall, sure, because he'd been in Breakfast Club as the nerdy character who needed to be fixed, like they all need to be fixed in Breakfast Club. But John Candy.
Wasn't it the very next year that John Candy is in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Yes, and I think his best performance. heartbreaking great performance.
Yeah, but never, ever would he pass for a teenager.
Not remotely close, no. As for Sloane, Molly Ringwald was considered, and I think she wanted the role, but then Hughes' theory on that was, it's too small a role for you. He wanted bigger things for her. And she really didn't go anywhere after she did the Hughes film. She was in two or three of them, I guess, and then her career kind of evaporated. She's been around all this time, but nothing big.
Yeah, she's currently in a couple of TV shows, I think, but nothing major. I mean, she's still working. And I always say, if an actor is making a living at acting, then they're successful. Just because they had better years in their past than they have now, people make fun of them, but that's not really fair. It's a lot to be an actor who's just making money as an actor.
Yeah, earning anything.
Yeah, to make a living.
You're doing better than probably 95% of people out there that ever wanted to be an actor, maybe even 98%. Mm-hmm. And also, I think of the line Orson Welles had to Peter Bogdanovich when they talked about how, oh, that's the best one. Well, you only need one.
Yeah.
And he's right. One great film is better than most people will ever do. So it means something. And if you're in a film that people still care about after all these years, John Hughes' films have aged pretty well. We'll talk about his specifics in a minute here. But his films are beloved more than they probably were then. But a few more people in the cast. McClurg is fun as Grace! And then you did the Ben Stein thing already. He's also in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Chrissy Swanson.
Yes.
Who's Buffy in the movie, at least not the TV show. No problem whatsoever. And the Bueller parents married for real not long after this
film. Yeah, they met on set. So they got together on set and got married. And Matthew Broderick and Jennifer Grey fell in love on set. Mm-hmm. And they got engaged, but they never went through with it and got married. Mm-hmm.
Brother and sister. Okay, so John Hughes, the 80s legend, and his career is looked back at with so much more reverence now. Kind of like John Carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading some recent tweets by Guillermo del Toro, who's going on about how Carpenter is not nearly respected enough, which is true, but he was really pumping him up. He himself, Carpenter, seems to be a little pissed that his career was not respected at that time. And you look back at things like Escape from New York, Halloween, and The Thing. That's a career for anybody, and he did more than just those pictures anyway. But much like Hughes, people look back at him with way more reverence now than they thought at the time. It was those high school pictures this guy's making. Instead, now they're benchmarks.
Carpenter, yes, deserves more respect than he definitely got at the time. But Hughes never made even a mediocre film. You say Curly Sue was probably his worst film. Was it mediocre? I think it was better than a lot of the stuff that came out that year. It may have not been his greatest film, but you have a bar that's set so high. He never made a bad film. How about that?
Only eight in total.
Only eight films, but you know what? Eight either great or pretty good films is one hell of a career. Mm-hmm. And he obviously has this almost supernatural gift for writing. Because he wrote scripts to those three vacation movies. My favorite Christmas movie, Christmas Vacation. Hilarious and amazing. And he wrote the script for Home Alone. Still, people revere that as one of their favorite childhood Monster films. Hit too. He obviously had this incredible sense for story and for comedy and for timing. Last night, you and I went to the movies and we went and saw Neighbors 2. We kind of spent the whole ride home dissecting everything that was wrong with it. There were funny moments, but the logistical problems with it were so much that we just couldn't get over it. There were so many dumb things that didn't make sense. And they're also, they just really missed all the emotional beats of that film, which was either distracting or just made the film fail to capture us and invest us in it. Whereas John Hughes seems to get all those things right. He makes us emotionally invested, but then he never bores us. The pacing's amazing, and it's always hilarious, and you always care about the characters. These things are obviously harder to do than anybody thinks they are, because it's not something that directors pull off very often, and he pulled it off eight times.
I think you're giving a little too much credit to say eight good films, because I don't know that Curly Sue and even Weird Science are good movies.
Okay, six times.
I'll take three for sure. Ferris Bueller, Breakfast Club, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And those are right in a row, as I recall. That's enough for anybody. So the other ones are gravy. 16 Candles is a favorite for some people.
I love She's Having a Baby. I've always loved that movie.
Okay, and then he produced Only the Lonely, the other incredible performance by John Candy, in addition to Planes, Trains. And Steve Martin, who's obviously a legend, he only worked with Hughes that one time, and he thinks that's his best performance and most important movie in a way, because he knows it was so important to Candy. Apparently, Ebert met up with John Candy in a Chicago hotel, and Candy was smoking and drinking alone. This would have been late 80s, I guess. And Candy told Ebert that he felt bad because he always tried too hard in movies, I suppose sort of John Belushi or Chris Farley-esque. And he thought he took it too far and he oversold it. He wasn't happy with himself for that reason. Maybe that's one reason why he was overweight and ate and drank and smoked too much. And when you watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, knowing that this is the way that guy felt about himself, and knowing he's trying so hard, the character is trying so hard, and then people like Steve Martin, understandably, don't want to deal with this guy, but then eventually he falls for him. And if you think about where movies go when the last scene happens, does John Candy's character ever stay with the Steve Martin family in that house long term? Probably not, because how is that going to work out? But knowing that, whenever I watch that movie, fucking kills me, because it's funny. But Planes, Trains has got so much more depth, and knowing that Steve Martin also knows that, Hughes knew it, Candy obviously did, and Martin too, makes that movie special beyond anything else. So I love Ferris Bueller, and I love Breakfast Club, and the other ones we talked about, but that's the one I think might be the most important. Because of that detail, I would have known had this film critic not wrote it in a review. The writer, of course, was Hughes. He was an auteur on his second film because he was a writer, producer, director from that point on. The breaking of the fourth wall and the voiceover we get in this picture, did Hughes ever do that again? Maybe with voiceover, am I right about that?
Well, I'm breaking sure the fourth voiceover wall, definitely. She's having a baby, I think.
Okay, but breaking the fourth wall, and it happens a lot, including the very last scene of the film.
I love the breaking the fourth wall. I'm going to take this opportunity to express my theory of why I think Ferris Bueller works. Ferris Bueller as a character is not like most protagonists. Most protagonists are underdogs, right? And they're people that have to overcome something, and that's how the audience can immediately latch on and relate to them. They're good people. I wouldn't say Ferris Bueller's necessarily a very good person, and he certainly is an overdog from the start, and Rooney is this cartoonish villain. But while he doesn't resemble most heroes from most movies, I feel like the formula that Hughes was borrowing from was Bugs Bunny. He's clever, he's funny, he's confident, he breaks the fourth wall, and not only does he thwart his enemies, he hopelessly humiliates them. And Rooney may not be, he's more like a Wile E. Coyote. I know Wile E. Coyote and Bugs Bunny never met. But he never gives up, no matter how hard they beat him up, and you can almost see him in the aftermath of an explosion with a little plume of smoke coming from his head because he's failed once again to get this bulletproof protagonist. He even successfully dons costumes and personas the way that Bugs Bunny does. He manages elaborate feats that defy mechanical explanations. How does he get on that parade float? Doesn't anybody ask how he managed to pull that off?
Why is this kid out here in the middle of the day?
Yeah, why are they picking the two songs that he knows so well? Why does he even know all the words of Donkashane? But that's the sort of thing that would happen in a Warner Brothers cartoon, and you wouldn't question it because that's just how good Bugs Bunny was. Even like the physical comedy of him racing Genie home, where he's running through someone's house, and then he pauses to talk to the sunbathing girls, and then he jumps over the trampoline. Those are very cartoonish. It really mimics that charm that those Warner Brothers cartoons had. So I think Hughes is borrowing from that instead of what people were used to seeing in live-action films.
Ferris Bueller as Bugs Bunny. Maybe right? This is a Top 100 Project exclusive, or Next 100 Project exclusive. Never heard that before. That's good. I like it.
All right. Yes.
Right, so the movie was 2-3-5-1, and we watched the DVD, which is solid, fine. I think it's on Netflix, too, if you don't own the DVD. Fans, cinematographer was Tak Fujimoto, who shot Silence of the Lambs and The Sixth Sense for us on the Top Gun Project way back when. The editor, Paul Hirsch, who worked on Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and a lot of De Palma films. And they talk about how they structured the museum sequence and the parade and the way it all worked out together. And they changed a few little things, and suddenly the movie went from being okay in test screenings to awesome!
Mm-hmm. They also said that the script was really long, and they shot everything, and then more or less edited the script in the edit suite and just saw how it could work once everything was shot and finished. Their first cut was like 2 hours and 40 minutes long.
Woody Allen-esque with that.
Yes. Because
he pairs things down. We talked about Annie Hall. That was a murder mystery movie originally. Yeah. And there's no semblance of that in the final product anymore. Music, Arthur Baker, Ira Newborn, and John Robey. But of course, everyone's always going to think about, oh yeah.
Bow, bow.
And Twist and Shout. And of course, all the recurring uses of Donkashane, because it's in the movie being hummed a few different times in addition to On the Parade Float. Okay, there's a lot of influence. The 1990 TV series, I actually watched the pilot and right till the end. I don't think it lasted more than 1 year,
yeah, but
I was with
it
from
too.
The beginning.
Yeah.
That was the same year, I believe, when Fresh Prince started, and I watched them back-to-back on wherever the station was at that time. It was simply Ferris Bueller. Didn't have a day off. And here's something for a guy I work with, a friend of mine, Brett Morey. He's always wanted to write with me. I don't know, he doesn't just do this himself, but Ferris Bueller's sick day as an adult. But then Broderick and Hughes talked about doing a sequel, and Broderick didn't really want to. I don't know if Hughes did either. We talked about how he doesn't write sequels for himself. Broderick didn't really see the charm in that. He thought, this is a standalone kind of thing, and it's that perfect coming together of everything in one day. Why try to repeat that?
Yeah, many times when you make a sequel that isn't as good as the original, and it'd be pretty hard to live up to the original, you can kind of spoil the original.
Mm-hmm. Although people get hung up on that a little too much with the popular movies like the Star Wars and Indiana Jones films. Yes. You can always just watch the originals. And Ghostbusters comes out not that long from now. You're ruining my memories of the original movie. Well, you can always watch the original Ghostbusters and just never see the new one or only see it once. But anyway, I do get what you're saying. It does maybe hurt it, especially if you go back and you change what characters are really all about, like Darth Vader. But we've talked about that plenty in other podcasts. More influence. Obviously, the Bueller, that's been done thousands of times in different ways by people just in life and in other movies and TV shows. Deadpool reprises the post-credits scene in its own post-credits scene, right down to the very last thing. And you guys see Deadpool, you will definitely enjoy it. I've never been the biggest Ryan Reynolds fan, but I can see why he wanted to do this movie so much, because he is great in that, and downright hilarious a lot of the time.
When we talk about how few actors could probably pull off Ferris Bueller, I think Ryan Reynolds is one of those actors that probably could.
He's too smug.
He's a little too smug, but I think of, what was that, Van Wilder, which was...
Too smug.
Okay, fine, but he was doing that same sort of Ferris Bueller.
It was a college version of Ferris Bueller, definitely. Those who like Van Wilder would certainly agree with that. I can see what they're saying. I just didn't like that movie because I didn't like him in that movie. But in things like Deadpool, he's very good. All kinds of popular bands name themselves after characters or lines of dialogue from this film. And that happens with plenty of movies, no doubt. But this one has inspired quite a few different bands. And then The Simpsons, again, they've done it so often with other films, they parody when Skinner tracks Bart cutting class one day. The awards and list section is not very long. No Oscar nominations of any kind, including for the screenplay. The movie was put in the National Film Registry in 2014, the same year as Big Lebowski and Saving Private Ryan. And it made no AFI lists, but it was nominated for a lot of them. Top 100 Laughs, Top 100 Cheers, I guess inspiring Cameron not to kill himself. Top 100 Songs with Twist and Shout. And here's another example of an original song that was used in a movie, nominated for that list. It should be only original song, but they did break that rule a lot on the Top 100 Songs list. And the Top 100 Quotes with... He says it twice in the film. Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Wait, so they nominated Twist and Shout for original song?
That's what I saw.
Not Oh Yeah, which is a way more associated with this film.
It's been in other films too, Oh Yeah.
Sure, but Ferris Bueller really introduced it to the world, and it makes the movie in so many ways. And it, every scene that it's in is just so perfect, whereas Twist and Shout is a great song, but it's hardly an original song. And you just take any song that's well-written and popular. It could have been Twist and Shout, it could have been a thousand songs.
You know, one thing about Oh Yeah, it's only at the end of the film when Rooney's on the bus going back to the school, I guess.
Is it?
It's still daylight. Now, it is June, so it would be daylight at 6 o'clock. And this is one of those things that the internet points out, and they're wrong to imply that it should be dark, because it wouldn't be in June in Chicago, or Chicago area. But I guess the idea is that he was going to hide out in the bus for a little while, and this is one of those things, again, they edited this differently. That would have been in the body of the movie, not as a credit sequence.
Hmm.
So that's why he's on the bus, and why the kids are going home at 6 o'clock. But you can make all kinds of arguments, including the fact that it's still daylight because it's June, and also the kids are on this bus because they went to some late field trip.
Isn't the song playing when he's running through the backyards, trying to get home and racing his genie?
No, it's da-da-da-da.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Great soundtrack, too. Mm-hmm. Great score.
Mm-hmm. I guess you can credit Baker Newborn and Roby for that part, because the most famous music is not theirs. All right, well, last thoughts on Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
It's aged well. If you liked it when you were younger, totally revisit it. You won't be disappointed. I loved watching it again. It had nostalgia, but also just all that energy and charm that it always had for me.
And we released this very specifically around this time. People are going to be talking about this movie just like they should be Thelma and Louise when we released that one. We're not dummies. So that's one reason why we picked this movie, and I enjoy it too. But as I've made very clear, Planes, Trains means a lot more to me. And Breakfast Club is also, I think, a little bit better. If I had to pick them, this would be my third of those three favorite, but it's still damn good.
I think Breakfast Club is probably the most treasured John Hughes film. But I don't think there's a John Hughes film that I like better personally than Ferris Bueller.
It's the most enjoyable of those three. Because the other two, and it's important that they do, they get awfully serious a lot of the time.
Yeah, Ferris Bueller kind of flirts with it. It doesn't stay completely silly.
But it's pretty light and a lot of fun. Okay, when we drop our next 100 Project podcast on you, we'll be going back 75 years. It's Henry Fonda and Barbara Stanwyck in the pratfallen comedy spectacular, The Lady Eve. So the coming attractions trivia for The Lady Eve. How many movies did Preston Sturgis have on the top 100 laughs list, and did any of them rank higher than The Lady Eve?
For the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, you can go to our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, you can visit our full roster of films that we've covered that include all 123 movies that ever made the AFI's Top 100 lists, either in 98 or 2007, and of course lots of other titles that we've picked. Also, while you're there, please rate us and review us. It helps people find us, and we love that. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we are both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And once more, before we go, I would like to warmly thank our sponsor, SparkPlugCoffee.com.
What are you still doing here? The podcast is over. Go home.
And cut.